From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The University of Utah neuroscientist Perry Renshaw calls it the Utah paradox. We go out into the mountains for the beauty and the exhilaration, and our dopamine levels go up. For some, though, the altitude of those mountains makes serotonin levels go down. So the altitude could be one of the factors that explains suicides in the Intermountain West. But there's more. There's at least one study that shows states with high Mormon populations have higher youth suicides. So you take that, and then bullying, and then just the way young people's brains are wired, and you've got a confusing mixture of elements. What we do know is that suicide rates for young people in Utah are double the national average, and they're climbing. But why? That's what we're talking about after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, wealth advisors since 1982. Albion values local organizations helping to enrich the community through the power of ideas. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. In July, the State Department of Health released a report that showed suicides among young people in this state have nearly tripled since 2007. To put that in perspective, think about it this way. For kids 10 to 17, suicide is now the leading cause of death. A new documentary film airing on public television station KUED tonight puts it this way. Every single day in Utah, two teenagers will attempt to kill themselves. Now, we should say right up front that this is a deeply emotional and confusing issue, and that for some, even listening to a conversation about it can lead to thinking about the unthinkable. So you should know there are people you can call and places you can go to work through these feelings. We have a list of resources on the Radio West website. I'll be mentioning this a few times during the broadcast. What we wanted to examine today was, why is the Utah suicide rate double the national average? What is it about this place? Is it the culture? Is it the environment? Does something help us explain all of this? And we invite you to join us throughout the program. If you have comments or questions, you can call us at 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Frank Feldman. He's an independent filmmaker. He directed and produced the documentary film called Hope Lives, Preventing Teen Suicide, which airs tonight at 7 o'clock on KUED Channel 7 here in Utah. And Frank Feldman, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
Featured on the program and joining us here on the documentary and joining us here is Dr. Doug Gray. He's a suicidologist and a psychiatrist with the University of Utah School of Medicine. And Dr. Gray, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I guess I wanted to begin, Frank, what got you thinking about this as you were starting to put together the film and what you wanted to really approach?
Well, it was really – it got started in just sort of I'd come across a couple articles just, you know, from local media outlets that were talking about the issue. And I got just thinking about it and – realized that there probably hadn't been enough done on the topic. And as I just started looking around and became more and more aware of the high suicide rate, not just in Utah, but throughout the Intermountain West,
right.
it felt like a story that I wanted to tell.
Yeah.
So, you know, that it just kind of pulled me in for a year of my life. So.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the film as we go. Dr. Gray, is Utah unique?
So I get asked that question all the time.
Yeah.
Why is the suicide rate in Utah so much higher than the rest of the United States? Actually, that's false. The Rocky Mountain states are higher.
So you can't
than the
just
rest
tease
the
out
states.
Utah.
No, we've got to say, why are we similar to Montana and Nevada and Colorado? I've been asking that question of audiences for many years. And then one time I was giving a talk and the next speaker was Perry Renshaw, who's a brilliant scientist we have in our Department of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. And I asked the audience why would Utah and the Rockies have these high rates? And he was studying brain metabolism in depression and seeing effects of high altitude on treatment-resistant depression. And so he put his hand up and we started talking, and then we decided we had to talk after he finished his talk. And if you look at a map of suicide rates in the United States, and then you look at a map of altitude, they look like the same map.
Yeah.
It turns out the effects happen at about 2,000 feet and above and continue to escalate. So there is a factor there that we have to deal with being in the mountains. And of course, there's a lot of great things about being in the Rockies, and Perry and his team are looking at treatments that might be able to help with high altitude type depression.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. I'm really interested in that. But is that the only answer? I mean, so Rocky Mountains, okay, high altitude, there you go. But there's also a cultural factor that comes up in the film. It's got to come up today. We're going to talk about it the latter part of the program as well, and that is that there is a conservative religious culture. What can you say about that part of it, if you can?
Well, I think when they've studied religions across the United States, if you're a Catholic and you live in the Catholic part of Boston, there's a slight protective factor that way. If you're a Baptist and you live in the Baptist Bible Belt, there's a slight protective factor.
Wait, what does that mean, a protective factor?
I mean, the suicide rate would be slightly lower if you live there versus somewhere else.
Right.
Because there's probably more social support. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that can work against you if you were gay and experiencing negative affect from the church or from your family. We do know from – we don't have good studies looking at those issues with suicide completers, but when we studied suicide attempters, so there's overrepresentation of LGBT and kids, and we know that this can be a great stressor, but it depends on the family and the religion and what's acceptable or not. I mean, there's a lot of variety there.
But wait, you said Catholics in Boston, there's a protective factor. For Southern Baptists, there's a protective factor. Mormons in the Intermountain West, is there a protective factor?
It's never been studied.
Yeah.
But you would anticipate that in general that would be true based on those other studies.
That because there's a community of support, there would be fewer suicides.
Well, we know that
related to that.
I study people, that have died by suicide by interviewing their family members and their community. And certainly, what you learn is that a lot of them are isolated.
Yeah.
So if you think about any kind of social support, whether you're getting it at school or from your family or from church, any of those things could be helpful.
So you don't buy that the LDS Church is causing young people to kill themselves necessarily as a general rule?
I don't think we have any research in that area, whether it's the LDS Church or other churches. What we do know is we've been able to study kids, LGBT kids, and we know they have higher rates of depression, mm-hmm. higher rates of anxiety, higher rates of suicidal ideation, and higher rates of suicide attempts. We just haven't had the funding or the study to really look at
the particular religious component.
Look at that, and also to look at suicide completers, which is those studies are expensive, take a long time, and hasn't been looked at as well as we'd like to.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. I want to talk with you, Frank, a little bit about some of the stories in the mm-hmm. film, and I want to play David Iyer Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Introduce us to him.
David, he's about 28 now, but when he was a teenager, he'd kind of hit this point in his life where he realized that life was going to take a lot of effort and work, and the effortlessness of growing up a bright, privileged kid.
Things that come easy to him.
Things that come easy to him. Yep. Just, they just weren't going to they weren't going to carry him through to adulthood. So he was kind of in this just state of turmoil. And then he a couple key things happened. He broke up with his girlfriend, and he wrecked the family car.
Yeah.
And then he attempted to end his life within like a day after that.
I want to play that part where he talks about the family car situation, because it seems like, and Dr. Gray, you can help us talk about this, because I think it's so interesting, because it raises the question of just how impulsive this decision can be. What he's done is basically totals the family car.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not thinking clearly about it. It's like, you're fine. But he's like, oh, my parents are going to have to. And this causes him, as you say, a day after or something like that, to jump from a building, as you'll hear in the story. But it gives you a sense of how just the slightest thing can really make a young person do something impulsive. Here is a moment from the documentary film Hope Lives, Preventing Teen Suicide.
And I didn't like have a great idea of how car insurance worked, so I thought we'd just have to pay out of pocket the amount that the car was worth. And I was like, oh, man, I just cost my parents all this money. I don't have that money. I feel like, you know, like a jerk and wasteful. I don't want to see my parents suffer. And literally the next day at 1 a.m, I made a plan to jump off a building. Looking back, I can't imagine why those factors were enough to make me do that. But they were at the time. It's incomprehensible to me. I've got enough distance from it now that I just say, really? That was enough? But you feel things when you're a teenager in ways that are indescribable and just so final. I think that it was rooted in something that was deeper and did take longer to manifest itself, which was an unwillingness to grow up, for lack of a better word. Unwillingness to face the kind of cause and effect challenges that life throws at you in the course of a normal life.
Dr. Gray, what's going on in his brain at that time? Because what's interesting about that clip for me was him talking about the fact that it's rooted in something deeper. It's in that anxiety about, oh man, I got to confront life at some point. But what's happening in his brain?
The teenage brain is still developing, and it's actually getting pruned. A lot of neurons are getting pruned. It's becoming more efficient. There are more excitatory neurons working than inhibitory. That changes over time.
Yeah.
And as the brain gets insulated, each of the wires gets insulated. That's called myelination. You see these adolescents be able to make better and better decisions in terms of weighing risks versus rewards and thinking more long-term instead of short-term. But in the middle of that process, adolescents can be very impulsive and, you know, and I look back at my own adolescence, I was a skateboarder, and I remember going so fast. And the only way to really stop was to hit the curb and to throw myself in the air and to bounce on the grass. And I thought that was a fine way to stop.
Right.
So I can remember that. So there is this impulsivity, and when bad things are happening, maybe they pile up a little bit. I think an older adult might see, you know, option B, C, D. And for some teenagers, they get boxed in. Yeah. They don't see solutions. They also haven't learned to maybe talk about their problems, so they're just sort of stuck with it. They don't know who to talk to. And for some reason, for a very short period of time, suicide can seem like an option.
Yeah. In the film, you talk about, Dr. Gray, how there's a portion of young people who attempt suicide. It seems like a significant number who are high achievers. They can't really deal with the idea of failure yet in their life.
Well, when we think about adolescence, we think about, you know, biopsychosocial. So biology might be that a teenage girl gets depressed for no reason, has a great life. It turns out her mom got depressed at the same age, and so did her grandma. And this is just biology and requires medication. And then we think of social stressors, you know, like failing a class or parents getting divorced, things that cause stress for the adolescent. And then the last one is psychological, that some people, their life is actually going pretty well, but they don't think it is. Hmm. They're perfectionists. They beat themselves up and they get stuck in their own head. And you certainly want a good therapist to help you sort of broaden the way you think so you don't get stuck like that.
Yeah. I want to ask about the idea. Another component of the film, Frank, is the bullying aspect. Mm-hmm. Beatrice Lark Washburn, young transgender girl. Would you introduce us to her? Because I want to talk about her, the way her story plays into all of this.
Yeah. Beatrice, let's see, she, when she was about 15, she had a learner's permit, and she'd been actually struggling for quite a long time with depression and multiple attempts. I can't remember what grade she was in for her first attempt. But it had really been going on for quite a while, and her mom was fully aware of the situation at this point. She knew that Beatrice had come out to her. And Nan, her mom, really thought that Beatrice was finally sort of in a good place. She still had all the dangerous materials out of the house, but as she says in the film, she'd never thought of an automobile in the way that she needed to.
Yeah.
And they were on vacation up at the family cabin, and Beatrice had come to her and said, "Hey, can I borrow the car? I want to just practice driving." And she was like, "Yeah, sure." And then that was her final attempt.
So one thing that's interesting about Beatrice's situation, now she mentions, and you lay this out in the film, she is pretty ruthlessly bullied.
Oh, yeah, the bullying, yeah.
I mean, intensely bullying. And I think what's interesting about this is she mentions at one point that she just got used to this kind of pattern where she says at one moment at least 9 times a day someone is calling her a faggot.
Yeah.
Hated going to school. Mm-hmm. Now, so clearly that's playing a role. But then here's the other interesting thing about the story.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Gray, you can talk about this part as well. So they start to homeschool her. And now she becomes isolated.
Yeah.
So the on some level, the bullying sort of goes away, but then she's got this social isolation. So it didn't really fix things. What's happening there?
Well, I think Dr. Gray mentioned earlier that this the risk factor of the isolation, right? The being isolated. And I mean, I remember as a gay Mormon kid in rural Oklahoma, the sense of isolation was horrifying, right? Now, I never took those steps, but I remember how alone I felt, right? And so it was I feel like I could understand where Beatrice was at this point in her life to a certain extent. I can't put myself in the whole thing, but it was a harrowing
That's the word.
Years.
Yeah, that's the word mother uses. Yeah. What's happening? The isolation is just causing, it's just making another factor in the stew, I suppose.
Sure. So if I was, you know, her clinician, I would be thinking, how can I reduce that isolation? Is there a smaller school that's a little bit kinder, gentler, where this teenager would fit in much better? Some of the homeschool programs, the more sophisticated ones, they actually get people regionally together to go on a hike or to go ice skating in the winter and do things like that. So there's a recognition now in some of the homeschooling programs that you've got to avoid that isolation. Hmm. There's the Utah Pride Center where a teenager could go to get support and help and meet other people that have been bullied and form kind of a bond with them and feel like, hey, we're in this together. We've got to help each other. So my clinician mind is, okay, we got to help you so you're not isolated. We got to problem solve. And if A doesn't work, we go to B, then C, keep working through till we find a group that you can join that you feel comfortable with.
And there's a sort of a theme, at least in a couple of the stories, Frank, that I don't want to play Beatrice's situation where she's in the car. She attempts to kill herself that way. The car rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at this moment she says, reflecting back on this experience, this, and let me play this, and I want to ask you something about it.
Cool.
The first thought when the right wheel came off and I started to flip up like this was, I want to live. And I think this is probably true universally for suicides. The moment you no longer have any control, the moment it is no longer your decision, everything in your body will just scream out, don't let me die. I got this sudden rush of every possible reason I might want to keep living, everything that might keep me alive, and just suddenly realizing that I had made the biggest mistake ever. No matter how big of a burden I was to my parents, the burden of my loss would be that much greater. And I screamed. And I screamed in a way that I don't think I could scream again unless you pushed me off a cliff.
Dr. Grace, she says that's a universal, like her guess is. I'm guessing this is a universal thing. Do you think that's right?
Yes, I believe this is very common. Ambivalence is the word.
Yeah.
I'm suicidal. I'm not suicidal. I'm suicidal. I'm not suicidal. And they jump back and forth between those two. Interesting, because I'm an older doc and I've had a couple of my patients by chance who were suicidal off and on get cancer. And after that, they weren't suicidal. They were fighting for their life. So that ambivalence went away because now they were faced with death every day. And their ambivalence jumped to the other side. I've got to live. So, yeah, I do think there are kids that are struggling with really bad mental illness that are, you know, suicidal pretty strongly and less ambivalent. But the majority of these teenagers are ambivalent.
Yeah. Let's take a break. And then when we come back from a break, I want to talk about this, but come back to that environmental component, the altitude, which is fascinating. Frank Feldman, independent filmmaker, his new documentary, Hope Lives, Preventing Teen Suicide, airs tonight at 7 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. Dr. Doug Gray is featured in the film, a psychiatrist and suicidologist at the University of Utah School of Medicine. As I mentioned, there are more details about all of this on our website and resources where you can find some help and someone to talk to. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Utah's suicide rate for young people, talking about what the dynamics are that are in play here. There's some culture here. There's some environment. There's also just the sort of things that are going on in young people's minds. Frank Feldman is a filmmaker. His documentary, Hope Lives, Preventing Teen Suicide, airs tonight on KUED Channel 7. He's with us along with Dr. Doug Gray, a psychiatrist and suicidologist with the University of Utah School of Medicine. Let's come back to this question of altitude. Frank, there's this paradox that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Gray, you can talk about this too. That Dr. Renshaw, you mentioned Perry Renshaw, he's featured in the film, talks about that paradox where you go out into the mountains for beauty and exhilaration and it gets your dopamine up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yet those at least inclined to this issue for altitude and makes their serotonin drop. So there's this weird thing going on. Say something about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's you know, I think Utahns in general, or at least so many of us, enjoy these mountains so much. And Perry Renshaw in the film actually talks about this idea that, you know, people move away and then they say that when they move back, I miss the mountains, right? And he says that he wonders if it's not the dopamine that they're really missing. And you know, it's really surprising to me that something so simple as just living at a higher elevation would affect our brains in that way. It's tricky, isn't it? Having that higher rate of depression because of that.
Yeah, it's really complicated, and I'm wondering, do you think the research that Dr. Renshaw is doing and the treatment seems like a kind of a big deal, a kind of a breakthrough in some way?
Well, it is a breakthrough in that when the altitude hypothesis first came out, I'd go to conferences and people would be saying, "Did you hear about that altitude thing?" And, you know, it's almost like, you know, what should we make of that? And then as Dr. Renshaw and colleagues did study after study, I mean, they went to South Korea and they did a study of altitude and suicide. Sure enough, strong relationship. They've done studies, animal studies, that show that if you put rats at higher altitude, there's a depression test for rats, believe it or not, and they some of them get depressed and don't and fail the test. So
how do you know a rat's depressed? We shouldn't go into this, but is it related to the way they eat food or something? Or
actually, my understanding is that there's a swim test and they swim in a circle and they can't get out. And if you deplete them of serotonin, like in their diet, they won't swim as long. They'll give up. They fish them out. They don't let them die. Yeah. If you give them, an antidepressant, then they'll swim longer. And so Perry's been able to put rats at different altitudes and show that they don't they give up easier if they've been at high altitude for a while.
Wow.
I want to put it in context that there's a lot of factors that affect suicide. So culture, pure culture is a big one. And Asia has the highest suicide rates, higher than North America. And we have much higher suicide rates than South America. There are gender factors. So 85% of these teenagers in Utah that die by suicide are male. But most of the suicide attempters are female. And that's a gender aspect. And then there's altitude. These are macro factors. And then you get more of the micro factors, like almost everybody that suicides has a mental illness they're struggling with. 90% have a mental illness. Gun availability is a big factor.
Yeah.
Genetics is a big factor. If you're adopted at birth, your risk of suicide doesn't come from the family that raises you. It comes from your biological family that you never met.
That's not nurture. That's nature.
There's a part of this that is nature. And obviously, it's multi-layered. You have to go through the macro. That if you're in Asia, you're going to have a higher rate than North America.
Yep.
And then the altitude factors. But then you get down to the micro, which is what's happening with that individual person.
Dr. Renshaw mentions that he says and I think he's got this tidy way of putting it, that we're hoping to decrease the rate 20% by 2020. That is, he's coming up with these treatment, hoping to get these, I guess, in the works by 2020. What do we know about that, and what are the treatments? Is it drug treatments? What is it?
Well, I know he's trying a number of treatments. One of them I'm aware of is creatine, which is a supplement that weightlifters might use or teenagers in athletics. It's reasonably safe, and he'd have to go through the biochemistry of that for you. I think they're finding it's working better in females than males, is what I've heard, and I think that. I think you have to think about it, that there's a whole bunch of people that would have depression no matter where they are,
right
at sea level.
Yep.
And then there's other people that might have a treatment-resistant depression because they're at high altitude. So I don't want you thinking everybody who has depression in Utah, it's because of altitude.
No.
Just some of the people are depressed have.
Yeah. But that does sort of get us to the cultural part, which, Dr. Gray, you just mentioned. Frank Feldman, how did you handle the LDS cultural part of it? Because this is a component of the film. How are you approaching that question?
Well, I really wanted to hear from people who were close to the issue, who were Mormon. So I found this group called the Mama Dragons. Mm-hmm. And these are Mormon mothers of LGBT kids. And this, they while they're not specifically focused on the topic of suicide, it's something that comes up a lot in their online forum, and they hear reports a lot, far too often.
Let me play this moment too,
sure,
because I think this does raise the question. This is Holly Hancock, She's an LDS therapist who she – I guess she's not necessarily with Mama Dragons herself, but she deals with
– Yeah, she's issues. She's been sort of a honorary part of the group. She doesn't have a gay kid, but she's been able to help and provide resources and give advice to these mothers.
Unfortunately, recently, Mama Dragons are made aware of 2 or 3 suicides a week in the LDS LGBT community. When we get reports of another child who has taken their life, the question is why? What can we do? Why is this happening?
But how do you measure that, Dr. Gray? I mean, how can you account for or measure the influence of religious culture on decisions that young people might make to attempt or to complete suicide?
Well, I'm just going to approach this like a clinician. You have to have a group where you fit in. We don't do well in isolation. And I remember Mother Teresa one time saying that disease isn't the worst thing that can happen to a person, or pain or anything. It's being alone is the worst thing that can happen to a human being. So I if someone's isolated, I'm thinking about how can we get them connected somewhere with people that understand them, people who will listen, people who will support them. But also there are people who are very religious who are very kind. And they may not agree with the adolescent's decision about their sexuality, but they approach them in a kind and loving manner, and I think that makes a huge difference.
Sure, but isn't the counter also the case that a sense of religion, the possibility, the sense that their children are sinners, causes the opposite problem, causes rejection, and may cause depression or shame and guilt, and be a contributing factor to them making these attempts.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's true with any group that you're part of. If you're the outcast, it's got to be incredibly stressful and difficult.
Frank, you've got belief, you've got doubt, you've got this drive to be perfect, you've got this sense of guilt. I mean, there's a lot going on, not just in the Mormon community, but let's talk about the particulars of the Intermountain West, the Rocky Mountain States. There are a lot of Mormons here. There was a particularly polarizing policy where LDS church leaders have now labeled same-sex couples apostates, refused to let their children be baptized, those kinds of things.
Right.
Do you have a sense of those? I mean, we're going to be dealing with this after a break here in a moment, but do you have a sense of how that comes into play in all of this? Are you able to tell?
I don't know. I have a hard time actually trying to figure out what would cause, in my mind, just as a filmmaker, right? Trying to figure out why someone would want to take their life, right? Like that wasn't the question that was really of interest to me. I wanted to hear from people who had attempted and hear what they had to say about that attempt and to hear about their life since. And then I wanted to look specifically at prevention programs.
Yeah.
And through those prevention programs, I'm able to raise these other issues about bullying and whatnot. And so that was really my approach.
I should mention that there are a number of these programs mentioned. Lone Peak High School has a number of programs. There's a – what's it called? Hope Squad?
Hope Squads, yeah. It's part of the Hope for Utah model, which is proving to be pretty effective. They train up a group of kids from that school to be first responders in a sense. That might be the wrong way of saying it. But resources for the other students, peer resources. And then these kids – know members of the Hope Squad know where to whisk these other kids off to.
Yeah.
And it's by having this discussion in the schools, they're actually destigmatizing the topic of suicide. And it makes these other kids who are having dark thoughts be willing to go and seek out help instead of just sitting there and feeling that isolation, being alone in their depression.
Let me play one more moment from the film. This is David again. He says something really interesting. He talks about, he said that he, after he attempted, and he of course survived, and that he had to basically get forgiveness from his parents and his family for, as he says, insulting everything they care about.
Yeah.
This was an interesting take. Here's another moment from the documentary Hope Lives, Preventing Teen Suicide.
My parents loved me so much from the time I was born till the time I was 16. And I just said, hey, sorry, no, you know, I'm going to die now. And they did nothing to deserve that. Just raised me right, you know? And so now that I've kind of overcome it and outgrown it and everything, I'm just like really grateful that they were able to forgive me so that I can have a good relationship with them and a full life. And if I hadn't survived, you know, I don't know if my mom would have made it.
I know it's vastly oversimplifying it to say that you outgrow it, but the idea of overcoming it, is that an apt way of putting it? That you, since sort of, certainly if you're a young person, and there are all kinds of factors here, but you can get past that. Yeah?
Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons people come to see me. If you have something like bipolar disorder that's causing your suicidal ideation, you know, we can get you stable. But you may have flare-ups here and there during your life. And
yeah,
you may still have to struggle, just like if you had diabetes. Diabetes doesn't go away, but you can treat it and have a good life. If you're dealing with the fact your family and your church doesn't accept you, that's a crisis. And there may be ways of eventually sometimes you have to leave a group and form your own identity, which there's a certain amount of freedom there.
Yeah.
But getting there can be incredibly rocky and painful. And even in my own life, I've seen people forgive other people for things 10 years later, 5 years later. There's always an opportunity for forgiveness when there's family conflict. But I can also see the getting through that. It's a dangerous force they've got to go through to come out the other side and feel okay about themselves and have their own identity.
Dr. Doug Gray, psychiatrist and suicidologist with the University of Utah School of Medicine. Thanks very much for being with us, doctor. And Frank Feldman, independent filmmaker. His documentary film Hope Lives, Preventing Teen Suicide, airs tonight at 7 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. Frank, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For being with us.
Thanks.
We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the youth suicide rate in Utah and the Intermountain West, why it is for those from 10 to 17 years of age, suicide is the leading cause of death in this state. Joining us now is Daniel Parkinson, a psychiatrist and member of the advocacy and support group I'll Walk With You. It encourages Mormon families to create safe spaces for their LGBTQ youth. Along with Michael Barker and Benjamin Knoll, he co-wrote a forthcoming article for the Mormon Journal Dialogue. It's called The LGBTQ Mormon Crisis, Responding to the Empirical Research on Suicide. He's joining us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. And Daniel Parkinson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to have you back when so we can work through the particulars of the report, but I wanted to get some sort of basic things out of the way. Let's start with, you say in the title of the report, of your article, crisis. What do you mean by crisis?
Well, the crisis means we've got people dying on our hands, and it's an issue that is preventable, totally preventable. There are solutions right there available to us that we're not taking advantage of. So we're having a crisis. We're having people dying. The friend of mine who died last month, you know, he's not coming back. It's a crisis. But most importantly, it's the sheer numbers involved. The very fact that that the state has a doubling of suicides between the years 2011 and 2014, mm-hmm. and the elevated rate staying that high in 2015 and possibly rising in 2016, numbers aren't in, but a doubling in just 3 years there and a tripling in 8 years is, you know, among our youth. And that's just something they haven't talked about. And they haven't talked, you know, you can't call that due to the altitude. You can't say it's due to, you know, they have to look at what that is. So there's a crisis. And the people who work with LGBT youth know that, because we're seeing the kids kill themselves. Too many of us know people who have killed themselves. And so
do you worry, feeling desperate. Do you worry, Daniel, when you hear things like, oh, hey, we figured it out, it's the altitude, which is not to say that that's not a factor. Of course it is. We've discussed that and there's research.
Do
but do you worry that people are going to say, oh, if it's not conservative Mormon culture, it's not families rejecting.
People do
it's
say
not,
that.
Yeah.
And it's a little frustrating because we're not going to change the altitude. Yeah, I want them to look into it, but that's what's affecting the global suicidal rate. But it's not, you got to look at all the causes. You got to look at the guns. The people are killing themselves with guns. Let's talk about the guns. But in this case, I want to talk about other preventable factors that are totally available to us. And so we're ignoring those. We're ignoring the fact that there's an eightfold risk in suicide among LGBT kids who have rejecting families. You know, why don't we talk about that statistic? Because that's something we can do something about. We can't change the altitude. And when we talk about suicide, you got to keep in mind, yeah, there's lots of factors that lead to him. But if we have a couple of these factors that are totally ameliorable, Dr. Gray talked about treating the bipolar. Yeah, that's great. Let's treat the bipolar. But if any one person is laden with a lot of these factors, they're going to have the altitude, they're going to have the bipolar. Let's not give them one more. And the other one he talked about is the social isolation that comes from being gay or LGBTQ in our society, because they get a lot of social isolation. They get the rejecting families. And you topple that, put that on top of their other problems, and you've got something that is a crisis, but preventable if we can address just some of the risk factors. And here's some that are preventable.
Right. What are the numbers that you're coming up with? Because I think for a while there were these questions about, there's a lot of anecdotal impressions, guesses about the impacts of judgment and shame and rejection on young LGBTQ young people. But are you coming up with actual numbers? You say that high Mormon populations in the Intermountain West had a proportional increase in youth suicide. So you have actual numbers that state this.
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one to explain, but you have to put it all together. It's a puzzle, and you have to put it all together. And the most compelling numbers aren't specific to Mormonism. They're specific to rejection. And the San Francisco State University, where Dr. Caitlin Ryan has done amazing research with the Family Acceptance Project, she showed that there is numbers about rejecting families and LGBTQ youth. And she showed what those rejecting behaviors are, specifically not allowing them to associate with other LGBT people, not defending them when they're bullied, not allowing them to call themselves gay or lesbian, and a number of other things that are basically a checklist of what a lot of Mormon families do, and most did in my generation, hopefully less now. But when you have this research showing, yeah, the rejecting behaviors is critical, and then we have other research says showing that there's clear elevation in suicide in communities where the kids don't have GSA or specific programs to prevent bullying due to LGBT issues, that they have higher suicide attempts. That's also a problem in our community. Mm-hmm. When we have clear research showing that there's a higher rate of suicide and a much lower, substantially lower life expectancy across the lifespan in communities that are hostile to LGBT people, this research is clear and showed a greater suicide. So all of these things apply to Utah independent of the religion, but our community is in the category of a community that's hostile to LGBTQ. And so we have all those risk factors that come with it. And then the specific ones about Utah is this alarming, horrendous tripling of suicides in our youth. And it's only our youth that have seen that increase. So we have triple. What is that? We should be desperate to know, why did we have a tripling? Well, I suspect it's that a part of this is because of the LGBTQ issue, because of the nature of the discussion that has happened in the past 10 years and how this is causing homophobic comments to be present in our church meetings, in our families, and with the wider discussion, whereas the surrounding community has become more tolerant. So the kids are getting more exposed in the internet to a society that's
accepting. So they have something to compare it against.
Yeah. And so they're coming out younger. The kids are coming out. They're realizing they're gay younger. But then they're going to their families and they're still getting the rejection that belongs in the 1950s. And so all of a sudden it's a, you know, it's a really bad moment in time for these people, even though for the greater LGBTQ movement, it's obviously getting better because they're still getting these bad reactions, but they're coming out sooner. So they're much more exposed to it. And they're telling their friends they're gay. And then all of a sudden they're more likely to be bullied. And so it's sort of a bad mix for these kids. And so for me, yeah, it's not proven, but it's highly suspect. And then the statistic that Dr. Benjamin Knoll figured was that there's a proportional increase in youth suicide in other states with substantial Mormon populations. Now, he couldn't do that detail of an analysis to know if it's actually Mormon kids who are killing themselves. So it could be just a fluke, or it just could be the Rocky Mountain thing. But other states are having more modest but real growth in teen suicide. But it's very small compared to the Utah one. But it does appear to be proportional to their Mormon population. That was just an interesting finding he had that also makes me want to know, well, we need to look at this.
Yeah.
But
that
but
was one thing that that was one of the things that Dr. Gray mentioned, is that they haven't really dug into that particular point. So it seems like that makes sense to look into it.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Forgive me. But what also makes sense is to address what we do know. Because if you're saying, yeah, maybe we don't know if the completed suicides is higher because we can't prove that. But if we do know there's more suicide attempts among LGBT teens, what's wrong with addressing that? That suicide attempts are such a reflection of morbidity, of depression, of despair, of dysfunction. You know, that's a legitimate concern, even if we can't prove the actual suicides.
Yeah. You say that familial rejection is the biggest factor in LGBTQ youth suicide or attempts. And this struck me. You say in high rejection households, so you've got these sort of, you go from low to high, rejection, high rejection. In high rejection households, there's a tenfold increase in suicide attempts.
Yeah, that's crazy. Because that's totally preventable.
Hold on, because I'm curious. Proportionally, if you can tell, Mormon families, how many reject versus how many that don't? Can you sense that?
Well, if you look at the behaviors that are specified there, and, you know, I can't prove what all these Mormon families are doing. I can't observe. But it appears to be what, you know, what the Mama Dragons are describing in their communities, and even what they were doing before they became aware that their child was LGBTQ, or the parents I work with who in the I'll Walk With You group, what the messages they were giving their kids before they found out they were gay, it's a problem. They are describing the same things that are listed in Dr. Ryan's report. So, you know, I think that it's my opinion that it is, you know, an epidemic in our communities. It might be getting better because the millennial generation, even among Mormons, are more tolerant. Some of them are starting to have kids, but they're still a younger group. So I would say, yeah, it's epidemic proportions among, you know, in our communities, and it's certainly variable, and any one family might be different than another.
Yeah. If you're a gay teenager at Olympus High School in Utah, and you're being bullied, you're also worried about family rejection, you're worried about what this means for your religious perspective, and you're gay and you go to a counselor, what are the limitations? What can a counselor talk to you about?
Yeah, you know, they say they cannot discuss with them sexual orientation, and they cannot do any evaluation of that. It's part of the state law. So this is a state legislator. It's really, really highly open to interpretation. But basically, a school, yeah, they can say, oh, it's bad to be bullied. We can talk about this. They can say, oh, that's terrible that you're suicidal. We can talk about that. But if you're being bullied because you're gay, we can't talk about that. We can't go into that. We can't bring that up with your parents. Not that they necessarily should right away, because that could expose them to possible other problems if they are a highly rejected family. But just the point is they can't really assess it without the parent first giving permission. And so basically it shuts it down. They can't talk about LGBTQ issues at all in any school in Utah without fearing that they'll be crossing the line on that law. I mean, and that really complicates the ability to give the kids help that need it.
Well, that's the question. So it seems like what you're saying is that there is sort of built into the system a kind of denial from state leaders to be transparent about this as a factor.
Well, it's beyond denial. It's active suppression of information. And they see it as promoting homosexuality to actually talk about it, I guess. But yeah, I don't know if that's the same as denial. Denial is simply ignoring it. This isn't ignoring it. This is active persecution, in my opinion.
So when you look at the sort of the takeaway from your report, your article that you've come with, it sounds like, as you said, it seems like there's a little bit of hope. This idea, as you say, that millennial young people may be more open-minded about all of this, yet you still have this a lagging effect here. So it sounds like you're not feeling entirely optimistic in these at this point.
Well, it's a beautiful time in our country because things are getting so much better, and it is going to get better for our youth in 15 years. But I don't want to lose a generation between now and then, and that's what's happening. The people, they're in the middle of a culture war, and that's happening right now, and they are the victims. And so, yeah, it is encouraging to see how many parents do really want to change this, though.
Like Mama Dragons, that gives you hope.
Well, and they get all the press, and I love them. There's also the I'll Walk With You parents, and they're just silently in the background. These are active Mormons who want to stay in the church, who are trying to stay in the church, who also want to support their LGBTQ kids and other LGBTQ kids in the community. And so it's really heartening to see them, what they're doing, and also the trials they face as they're trying to do that in their communities.
We'll put a list of all of those groups, by the way, on our website as well.
Yeah, I really want to promote that one. I worked on a project, LDSWalkWithYou.org. I hope people will look at those videos at some point because it is showing a lot of these parents who are active in the church, who how they have them describe how they had to deal with it and how they had to learn how to approach the situation with their child.
It's Daniel Parkinson, psychiatrist, co-authored a forthcoming article for the journal Dialogue entitled The LGBTQ Mormon Crisis, Responding to the Empirical Research on Suicide, joined us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Daniel Parkinson, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.